This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, Dr. Robert George of Princeton University, Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop, and others for the 2021 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. You'll find a conference schedule and you can register at issuesetc.org.
I understand that President Biden demonstrates a degree of piety and ritual, but I don't know the value of someone's faith that can perform rituals to the neglect of their doctrine, and often not just to the neglect, but to the rejection of their church's doctrine.
Why all of a sudden are we going with the mind being right and the body being wrong, rather than our actual physical reality being right and maybe working on the mind to align with the body?
And that, in my opinion, is the biggest ideological danger in the Western world. People who are frightened witless of being considered bigots and therefore who do nothing to support the truth.
Jesus himself teaches that it is possible to lose saving faith. Once saved, always saved is just a lie.
This is Mary from Iowa. I love listening to Issues Etc. while walking on Iowa country roads.
Exodus 20 says, make no graven images. For many Christians, that's the second commandment. In my tradition, the Lutheran tradition, we number that with the first commandment. It's folded into the first commandment, having to do with having no other gods before the true God. But does that prohibition against making graven images, does it apply to every image? Because it does say make no graven image of anything, in essence. It also says don't bow down and serve those images as a god. There are Christians, Calvinists in particular, who say it applies to any image and every image. Do they consistently apply that? And when it comes to images in Christian worship, what is their salutary use? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be continuing our series, responding to Calvinist proof texts, looking at Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6, and the Reformed arguments against images in Christian worship. Dr. Jordan Cooper will be our guest. He's author of the book titled The Great Divide, A Lutheran Evaluation of Reformed Theology. The book of Proverbs will be our subject, in particular, the latter part of Proverbs 27, with Pastor Jonathan Fisk of The Mad Christian after that. And then Pastor Brian Wolfmiller joins us in hour two of Issues Etc., part 10 of our series, What I Wish My Non-Lutheran Friends Knew About, and today the subject is Election to Grace. Joining us for our series, responding to Calvinist proof text today, Exodus 20 and the Reformed arguments against images in Christian worship, Dr. Jordan Cooper, Executive Director of Just and Sinner, President of the American Lutheran Theological Seminary, and author of the book titled The Great Divide, A Lutheran Evaluation of Reformed Theology. Dr. Cooper, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me back, Todd.
Before we get into the passage itself and how it is variously read and applied, how much do you think the numbering of the commandments, and you'll have to explain kind of the divide on that one,
right,
contributes to this disagreement?
Yeah, it does. And certainly I think the Reformed would say that it does, very much so, because they would say that we actually ignore the second commandment. So let's talk a little bit about what that debate is. Now, when you look at the Ten Commandments in Scripture, there is no exact numbering, right? It doesn't say, here's commandment one, here's commandment two. So in some ways, we all have to figure out how exactly it is that we want to divide the commandments up, even though we're all working with exactly the same commandments, the same text. So there's a difference in how the Western Church historically had understood the commandments, where it was believed that the text that we're going to be looking at today in Exodus 20, the commandment against the making and worshiping of images was part of the first commandment. And the Reformed, on the other hand, divide those two commandments so that they're two separate commandments. And because of that, there is a heavier emphasis on this rejection of images. And so it's often going to be the accusation of the Reformed that we basically hidden that second commandment somewhere under the first, so we don't really have to worry about it. Of course, I would object to that categorization, but that's certainly how they see it.
There is also some history that predates Reformation squabbles over things like this. As to images, there was even, I think it's got its own name, the iconoclastic controversy or debate. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, sure. So this is a debate that the nature of images and the usefulness of images, how is it that they can be used or can they be used at all? This is a question that we see dealt with quite a bit, even in the very early church. So there is certainly a divide over this question, basically as early as we have evidence of spaces of worship at all. So we do have, going back to the third century, we can find numerous images of Christ. Usually, the earliest images we have tend to be an image of Christ as the Good Shepherd. The idea of the Good Shepherd tends to predominate in a lot of those early Christian art pieces before we get what we now think of course, as imagery of the cross, the crucifixion of Jesus being the central Christian image. But even as far back as that, you do find that there are some people saying that we should not have images in worship, or that we do not have any images in worship, which distinguishes them from the pagans, that distinguishes Christianity from paganism. So in some ways, that occurred just because of the fact that they didn't have their own church buildings. And that definitely shifts as soon as you have Christianity being legalized, the Edict of Milan, and then you have the building of, well, basilicas, or the conversion of basilicas into then Christian places of worship. And then there's discussion about the role of images now that Christians have enough finances on their own buildings to be able to do things like this. There are questions like, what should the sanctuary look like? What use should images be? This developed into what became known as the iconoclast controversy, which was settled in the 8th century at the Second Council of Nicaea, which is known as the Second Ecumenical Council, or sorry, Seventh Ecumenical Council is what I meant to say, which is the final of the ecumenical councils. So you had basically two groups. You had the iconoclasts and the iconoduals there. You had those who were opposed to the making of images at all because of the way that they viewed what the Reformed would describe as the second commandment. So they would see that the prohibition of images would preclude the use of images in worship, specifically use of any images of the Godhead, and that includes the incarnate Christ. So on the other side of that debate were people like St. John of Damascus, who's probably the most significant figure for the eventual decision that was reached there, who made arguments for the use of images based on the incarnation, the fact that God has actually made himself visible through the person of Christ. So the decision of the Second Council of Nicaea was in favor of images. It did not favor the conclusion of the iconoclasts. So when we look at debates today among the Reformed and Lutherans and others, we're really not doing anything new, right? We're not stepping into some debate that is new. This is something that has gone on in a disagreement that has existed since, as long as we have record of Christians making artwork.
The passage at hand is Exodus 20, beginning at verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them to serve them. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. How have the Reformed read this particular passage?
Yeah, so as they label this the second commandment rather than as part of the first commandment, as we've said, and what they're going to say is this prohibits the use of images in worship, particularly the use of images of divinity, so any images of God. And when that comes to pictures of Jesus, which is where this discussion often comes out today, it's argued that, well, because Jesus is divine, he is the second person of the Holy Trinity, he is the eternal Logos, because of that, we cannot make images of Jesus because he is divine. So the argument is that this prohibits any image of God in any sense, which often means that there are going to be no real images in worship at all. So if you go to a Reformed church today, one that is consistent with the classical Reformed approach to this, because there are some differences in churches today, but the sanctuary is often going to be very plain, because oftentimes images are seen as a distraction, one, but also as an instance of possible idolatry. So the sanctuaries generally are very empty, very plain. The emphasis is not on the aesthetics of the building, but on the message that is preached in the sermon.
So why is that a misreading or perhaps a misapplication of what's actually being commanded and required here?
Yeah, so certainly there is something that's being prohibited here. You know, obviously we're not trying to say that you just kind of ignore this part of the commandment. It's very clear, and there's something obviously that is being prohibited. So the question is, what exactly is it that's being prohibited? Now, if you're going to, you know, take the first part of this, say, at face value and say, well, look, it just says, don't make for yourself any graven image of anything that the heaven above or the earth beneath or the water under the earth and stop there. Well, certainly it sounds like what you're saying then is, well, you just can't make any image of anything, which would be a, not just in the context of worship, but it would be just a prohibition of images at all, so that we shouldn't carve or design anything whatsoever that is any kind of representative art. Clearly, that's not what's being said. And we know that that's not what's being said because we have scriptural examples of people creating all sorts of kinds of images and they're not condemned for it. In fact, the Israelites are commanded sometimes to make images. So the great example of this is that when God designed the Holy of Holies first, you know, within the tabernacle and then the temple, he commanded the creation of these two cherubim to stand above the ark. So these are these heavenly beings. And this is the central place of Israelite worship. This is the holiest place in the worship of the people of Israel. And within that holiest place, God has actually commanded the creating of statues of cherubim, which means that there was a command to have a kind of religious art in the very heart of worship, in the very presence of God. And so, in a sense, that's, they are graven images, right? So clearly that can't be what this is forbidding altogether. But along with that, you also have images on the veil there in the tabernacle and the temple as well of cherubim. So the creation of images and the use of images within a sacred space in the context of divine worship is actually something that was divinely commanded in the Old Testament. So the problem with reading this in such a way is that it would condemn other things. If it's read in that way, it would condemn other things that God himself commanded. So it cannot be read in such a way. So what is being said here? Now, really, I think the key is verse 5 here, which speaks about bowing down to and serving and worshiping graven images. And, you know, here we have especially the mention of, you know, things on the earth beneath. So if you look at the context of, you know, Israelite culture in the ancient Near East, there is a lot of idolatry. There are images that are used in worship, and that worship is given to false gods. And those false gods were represented by images of natural created things. So we have the example in the book of Exodus itself of the golden calf, right? That the Israelites worship this golden calf, and they're rebuked and almost destroyed for it because they, you know, they take all the gold that they have and they create this calf, and they say, well, this is the God that's redeemed us from Egypt. And so clearly that is the kind of idolatry that's being spoken of here. We even have that example in the same book of, this is the kind of thing that is considered idolatry, right? This is the kind of thing that's being condemned. And we see that played out, of course, throughout the rest of the Old Testament as well, that the Israelites are tempted to turn from their worship of God to worship of gods among their pagan neighbors. And that would often include the worshiping of some particular image of just an earthly thing, an animal or some other object.
So this is an extension, and why we number the commandments the way we do in the Lutheran tradition. This is an extension of, you shall have no other gods before you.
Yeah, exactly. So we're not ignoring this, right? We're not saying that this part doesn't matter, but we're saying that this is a description of part of what it means that we should have no other gods before Yahweh, before the one true God that we know is the triune God. And so this was a description to the Israelites, you shall have no other gods before me. And then there is a description of, well, what does that mean that we have no gods before God? And so then you know, Moses, as he explains, is given this by divine revelation, that that means you don't make the images of the pagan gods in the surrounding cultures and worship them, because they are not gods.
Dr. Jordan Cooper is our guest. We're responding Calvinist proof text today, Exodus 20, and the Reformed argument against images in Christian worship. What positive use did the church put these images to in the past?
I'm really excited to be talking about making the case against American revivalism.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about his presentation at this year's Making the Case conference.
And here we'll be dealing with the twofold character of this movement, namely its theological character, which is a form of Arminianism, that is, decision theology, and then what we all know so well, its practice, revivalism, as such. Both are pervasive in American Christianity and have become exports to other countries.
You can meet and hear Dr. Rast at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Christian greeting card makers, gift shop owners, laser cutters, church banner creators, ornamentalists, poster purveyors, jewelry designers, fine artists, hymn writers, wood carvers, UV bed printers, and authors all love Issues Etc. And you'll find our work at adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
It's our series responding to Calvinist proof texts with Dr. Jordan Cooper today, Exodus 24 through 6, and the Reformed arguments against images in Christian worship. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues Etc. Folks, Ad Crucem understands the proper use of Christian images in the church and home. Check out their wide assortment of beautiful products at adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com. Dr. Cooper, talk about some of the positive uses that the church has put these images to in historically, really up until the time of the Reformation.
Yes. Yeah. So we have, you know, as I said, we have evidence very early on, as early as we see any Christian places of worship, there are images that are connected with worship in one way or another. And as I said initially, that often is depictions of sometimes Old Testament stories. For example, we have a lot of early depictions of an image of Jonah and the whale. And the reason why that particular narrative shows up so much is because that becomes a picture of Jesus. And Jesus himself talks about the sign of Jonah. So this is this Old Testament narrative that serves as a picture of Jesus, as he was 3 days in the belly of the whale. So Christ was in the grave 3 days, and then Jonah came out of the whale, and Christ came out of the grave. He rose from the dead. We have, for example, a lot of very early images of Moses striking the rock in the wilderness as water pours forth, which Paul says is an image of Christ. Christ was the rock. So those are really interesting that those kind of things show up first, because I think it shows us something about what the earliest use of images was in Christian worship. And that was, it was really a way of teaching. It was a way of describing Christian truth and displaying Christian truth in places of worship. So that's when you have an image of Jonah and the whale, you have to do a bit of teaching to explain why that has to do with Jesus, instead of just having, for example, a crucifix like we most often have, and we see the prominence of that still very early on, but a little later than that. So we see that it has a teaching function. It has a teaching purpose, so that when people gather into worship, they see the signs and symbols that demonstrate truths about the Christian faith, and so that their mind is set on those things as they are gathering into worship. And as you said, it really is ubiquitous throughout the history of the church, though we do have, as I mentioned, to be fair, we do have some debates on this that do show up. There are some people who do appear and criticize the use of images for the reason that the Reformed do. So it's not like that's totally absent from church history, but the majority of the church has been, from the beginning, positively using images. And, you know, in looking at the theology of this, or the ideology behind this, the positive function of this, it would be very similar to exactly what God did in the Old Testament with the Israelites in using images of the cherubim. He's displaying something about the place that is the Holy of Holies. He's displaying that this is where the presence of God is, and that God is surrounded by these angelic beings, these angelic creatures. And the fact is that when we gather in worship today, we are gathered in that same divine presence that is with us, that is given to us in the Eucharist, the body and blood of Christ, for example. And so when we have those images of heavenly things, it brings our minds to that space, just as it happened in the Old Testament, that we are brought into the space of what's really going on, that this is heaven and earth joining together, that we are worshiping with the cherubim, we are worshiping with the departed saints, we are worshiping with all of creation, the triune God who is now in our presence as we are coming together before him.
If you would also address, and Calvinists will be quick to point out, there are genuine cases of the abuse of images in Christian worship. What are those?
Absolutely. There are absolutely abuses of images. And this is something that was very common in the medieval church, which is largely why the Reformed reacted. They didn't react in such a way for no reason. I mean, there were genuine cultural things that were going on. There was genuine real idolatry that was happening with images. So it's not like they were reacting against nothing. However, we do have to be careful that just because something is abused, that doesn't mean that we can say that we need to throw it out altogether. And we see the same kind of abuses with things that are divinely commanded, like the Lord's Supper, right? That there was so much superstition surrounding the supper, with a lot of practices that were very popular in the medieval church that we would object to and the Lutheran reformers would object to. Of course, that doesn't mean that Holy Communion is bad because it could be abused. It's divinely commanded, so it's not bad. So we would say that the same is true of images. So what are some of those things that could be abusive in terms of the use of images? Well, you can certainly see a kind of superstitious adoration of the image itself. You can see a kind of, you know, bowing down before an image because you believe that that image itself has some kind of sacred power attached to it. You could think about images in a way that is kind of is sacramental, which some parts of the Christian church do view images in that way, so that the image itself is giving grace in some unique way. Which, of course, we would say that's simply not what God has promised. God has promised that he is present in very particular things, and that's why we have the sacraments that are divinely commanded. So we can't go about attaching sacramental promises to images because God has not done that himself. So that can be certainly be a problem. The use of images of Mary and the saints in some contexts can be involved with what we speak about as like the cult of the saints, or the prayers that are offered to the saints, or the adoration of the saints in ways that would not be consistent with the scriptural practice. So, you know, for example, I've seen at a Roman Catholic shrine that was dedicated to Mary, which, you know, has its own questions, of course, but they have I remember seeing a statue of Mary that had a kneeler right before it. So they would have individuals kneeling there at the Marian statue, and they would be praying the rosary, meaning praying to Mary. So it's an instrument of worship in a way. I mean, they wouldn't say it's worship, but we would say that prayer is an act of worship. So it essentially is. So that would be a problem. So anytime that the image is taking you away from the worship of the triune God, that is when it becomes idolatry. And that's exactly what the context is here in Exodus, when it brings you to a place that you are bowing down before or worshiping other gods.
One idea that has often come to me when this subject has come up is that we are image bearers, but we are also image creators. It is part of what it is to be human, to depict things, mm-hmm. if only in our minds. And I have argued, you know, if I say the word Jesus and you picture the Sunday school illustration that is welded into your mind of Jesus praying in Gethsemane or something like that, that is an image. That is not
yes.
Jesus himself. That is an image, albeit a mental image, only kind of demonstrating that we cannot, even if we're not carving them out of stone or wood, we cannot avoid images of the divine.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And this is an argument that I've made as well, is it's really impossible just to say that you need to think of Jesus, but you can't think of him in a physical body. It almost becomes a docetic, meaning that this is an early Christian heresy that says that Jesus didn't have a physical body and he was just divine. But you're almost forced into that position, because if it's sinful to have an image of Jesus and it's sinful in your mind's eye to have an image of Jesus, what do you do when you come to a story that has Jesus's hands and feet and he's doing bodily things? If it's idolatry for you to think of a human body or to image him in any way, you know, even mentally, then you're really forced into this place where you don't really think about him as being physical at all, which leads you into a heretical Christology. So it really is inevitable. It is part of our created nature that we do have to have images. You know, it's similar, like when you just hear the voice of Jesus, when you're reading the text, you're often hearing some kind of voice in your head. What does that mean? Is that idolatry because Jesus's voice maybe didn't sound exactly like that? Well, of course not. This is just how we have to function. So I think it really does, this interpretation of this commandment puts you in a very impossible position where you are kind of trying to force out of your head anything that is physical with relation to Jesus, and then can lead you away from the understanding that Jesus is fully human. And I feel like even if you intellectually understand that, if you can't picture a real man doing these things in any way, how are you to avoid that? That thought of Jesus is just some kind of idea that has no real physical or clear implications in this real world.
So with about 30 seconds here, Dr. Cooper, how would you briefly describe the salutary use of images in Christian worship?
Yeah, so I would say the use of images in Christian worship, they can be used to teach. We see images, and images stick in our mind. They help us to remember things that the Bible teaches. They help us to remember stories. This is why we have picture books with kids. But as we grow older, we still need these images as well. It's part of how we're created. So there's the educational value. It also just helps to put our mind in the right place when we're entering into worship, because we are affected by our senses. We're affected by what we hear and what we see. And so images in worship help to set our minds through the senses of sight on the right thing, so we understand why we're here, why we are gathered together in worship together. And especially as you have the many crosses we see in Christian worship, or crucifixes in Christian worship, it demonstrates to us and continually reminds us of the centrality of Christ and him crucified for the forgiveness of sins, which is at the very center of our faith.
Dr. Jordan Cooper is Executive Director of Just and Sinner, President of the American Lutheran Theological Seminary, author of the book, The Great Divide, A Lutheran Evaluation of Reformed Theology. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Cooper, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will be back into the book of Proverbs with Pastor Jonathan Fisk right after the break. From struggle to jubilation, the Psalms reveal the human experience. The Psalms also serve as a wonderful tool for devotion and reflection. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Engaging the Psalms, A Guide for Reflection and Prayer. Learn more about this new devotional resource at issuesetc.org or purchase Engaging the Psalms by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Engaging the Psalms, A Guide for Reflection and Prayer.
Casting Christ's net on the internet. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life his design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.